Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks.
Folks, welcome tonight to the Sydney Institute. We have an unusual night tonight. Both of our speakers have spoken for us before. Paul O'Sullivan, last year, is in his capacity as Director General of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, and Bob Carr spoke for us most recently when he was Labor Premier of New South Wales. But today they're going to talk about a different topic, which is Spy Fiction 2 Views. So I'll introduce our speakers briefly. They'll talk for about 15 minutes each, and then we'll take questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. Bob Carr, of course, has a background in the trade union movement and journalism in politics, but most particularly as Premier of New South Wales from 1995 to 2005. But he's also an author, and his most recent book, and Janet Grundy's got some copies outside, My Reading Life, Adventures in the World of Books, which includes a section on spy fiction and crime, has been very successful. The money from the book has been given by Mr. Carr to Interplast, Australia and New Zealand, which does plastic surgery mainly on cleft palates in foreign lands, and that book has been very successful. So he's going to talk for a second, and we lead off with Paul O'Sullivan, whose background is in the Commonwealth Public Service, primarily in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, but he also worked for the Prime Minister's Office in 2004 and 2005, and since 2005 has been Director General of ASIO. So Mr. O'Sullivan, we'll lead off with you. We're followed by Mr. Carr on the broad topic, Spy Fiction, 2 Views. And some of you may have seen Paul O'Sullivan's terrific article in this morning's Sydney Morning Herald. Paul, you're welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, for inviting me and Bob to come and talk with you tonight to talk a critique about our views about spy fiction. It's worth, I think, starting off by saying that the spy fiction that we read is only one slice of spies and spying in popular culture. Popular fascination with espionage and counter-espionage is born out in films, in TV series. All of you can probably remember The Avengers, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Spooks, in comics, and now I'm told in video games, not to mention spoofs like Get Smart and Austin Powers series that send up spying and spy fiction and sends up also our fascination with it. As you may have inferred from Jared's opening comments, I enjoy reading spy fiction, but I think it pays to discriminate. There is literary fiction with spies and spying in it. Think of Conrad's The Secret Agent or Green's The Quiet American, McEwan's The Innocent, Norman Rush's Mortals, Christopher Cosh's The Memory Room. And then there is spy fiction written by the likes of Ian Fleming, Robert Ludlum, Tom Clancy, Daniel Silver, with its thrills and intrigues, half-truths and caricatures, and above all, its gripping plot lines. Spy fiction also has a grown-up cousin, the adult spy fiction of writers such as John le Carré, Len Deighton, and Alan First. The boundaries, of course, are not always so neat. Adult spy fiction often has all the twists and turns of the classic spy thriller, and the themes of trust, loyalty, betrayal are common to all types of spy fiction, whether as part of an exploration of character, morality and power, or more as a narrative device to build intrigue and suspense as the plot twists and turns to some labyrinthine solution. Perhaps what sets adult spy fiction apart is the ambition, one might even say the pretense, to transcend the limits of genre and stereotype. The focus is less on the tricks of the trade, although there's usually plenty of that, albeit mostly as a metaphor for dissecting the meaning of spying as a vocation, and in so doing, exploring deeper questions of politics, history, morality, and identity. And here, John le Carré looms large. He said, and I quote, "For decades to come, the spy world will continue to be the collective couch where the subconscious of each nation is confessed." Readers familiar with Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which was the first of le Carré's Smiley trilogies, will remember also that Bill Hayden, the British blue blood turned Soviet mole, takes it for granted that the secret services were the only real measure of a nation's political health, the only real expression of its subconscious. Contemporary spy fiction has a history. It emerged around the start of last century, about the same time that spying began to get organised professionally in the form that we know it today. And I'm grateful, by the way, to Stephen Loosely for giving me a copy of Hugh and Graham Greene's book, The Spy's Bedside Book, which has a lot of excerpts in it, as some of you may know from reading it, of those early spy stories. As with early crime fiction and its part-time sleuths, early spy fiction was the province of the amateur, the remarkable gentleman in William Le Quoz's stories, who, as patriots, protected their compatriots, drawing in large measure on reserves of raw courage and native intellect. Readers of Philip Knightley's The Second Oldest Profession will recall he, in fact, argues that early spy fiction, particularly Le Quoz's writings, had some influence on the British decision to establish its first formal civilian intelligence service. And so, with the institutionalising of espionage and counter-espionage as aspects of modern statecraft during the 20th century, came the exploration of the relationship between the individual, organisation and society that has been grist for the mill in spy fiction ever since. Now, naturally, plots and situations vary. Some are vehicles for the heroic individual to save the day, just in time, once again, against all the odds. More sinisterly, there's a subgenre of spy fiction that embodies deep-seated suspicions about the corruptibility of power. This is a world where the enemy is within, a world where nasty organisations or a cabal within them turn on the individual wantonly and without prejudice, as in the Jason Bourne series. Some, like Greene's Our Man in Havana or Rush's Mortals, find comedy or irony in the discordance between context and purpose. Why on earth would that spy be there? Other strands of spy fiction are deeply pessimistic, committed to exploring the ways spying ultimately grinds down or destroys its protagonists. In the face of secrecy, suspicion, moral relativities and betrayal, there are no heroes left standing, only hollow, dejected, seriously compromised individuals. It's as though in the professional world of spy versus spy, the values of commitment, of patriotism and higher purpose would render the protagonists as innocent as Le Quoz's spies are amateur. "We are all the same, you know. That's the joke," says Fiedler to Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. No one personifies the heroic individual as boldly, as brashly, as downright sumptuously as 007. As we know, he's a composite figure, one part dandy, one part deadly assassin, one part derring do, most part fantasy, shaken, not stirred. However, the Bond we know in Fleming's novels is more complicated and less likeable, I think, than the Bond we know in the films. On the job, Bond is a consummate professional. Well, mostly. He'll take on all comers, and just as well, because in Fleming's world, the threats to Western democracy and global order are polymorphous. Smersh, the Soviet agency whose name means death to spies, is recognisably Cold War. Others, such as Spectre, a syndicate of international criminals led by Blofeld, or the diamond-smuggling Spangled Mob, don't fit neatly into any frame or epoch. And that might be a reason, perhaps, why Bond endures. As an employee, Bond is something of a mixed blessing. He's loyal, but in dispatching with enemies, he can be insubordinate. He does his paperwork, but seems willing to fudge the record. In the novels and the films, there's a strange, relentless juxtaposition of danger and pleasure, discipline and luxury, focus and appetite. Sometimes these blend into one another, and other times they clash. As, for instance, when Bond, longing for his lunch, is desperate to wrap up an important briefing on Sir Hugo Drax with M, who, Bond can't help notice, never seemed to be interested in food or sleep. And I agree with him, it's a strange quality for the head of an intelligence service. Fleming's Bond fears, suffers, has doubts and dark thoughts. He acknowledges at least to himself his foibles and hypocrisies, and on occasion he admires the traits in those he must defeat. There are double entendres galore, albeit more so in the films, and all part, with notable exceptions like Miss Moneypenny, of the inevitable conquest, not just by Bond, but of Bond, in a classic honey trap orchestrated by one of his many enemies. After all, he may not be quite a polymath, but we know he is a cunning linguist. There is a sheer exuberance of tradecraft involving physical prowess, tricks of the trade, and especially in the film's gadgets. So entrenched has this metaphor for the spy world become, it's easy to forget that if Bond can do it all, and it seems he can, this has less to do with Q and than with the 007's discipline, training and focus. There's none of the predicament of Colonel Mercier, the French military attaché cum spy in Alan First's The Spies of Warsaw, who was sent to Poland with just 6 weeks of training under his belt, and just one of which covered the management of espionage. Readers of Fleming sense that Bond has no real identity beyond his job and beyond his status as 007. It's almost as though the very openness and optimism of Bond's identity, his phoenix-like indifference to setbacks, forestalls the deeper questions that infuse more serious spy fiction writing. And that's probably why he's been mimicked, spoofed, deconstructed, and particularly by the writers of adult spy fiction, strongly reacted against. So much so that one could plausibly argue that realism in spy fiction has defined itself as much against Bond as the actual world of espionage. It's precisely the question of identity and its implications for values like loyalty, courage, honesty, friendship, belief that fascinates serious writers of spy fiction, as well as the literary interlopers who occasionally tackle the genre. Who is this spy who lives secretly, lives a double life, assumes various identities? And what are the psychological and moral effects of managing assumed and covert identities? It occurs to Christo, the character in First's Night Soldiers, that if you had nothing else in the world, you could at least have a secret. But can the spy in fiction have that secret and other things too? Can the spy maintain his or her normal identity? Can the spy balance work and domestic life? What are friendships, commitments, trust? Leonard Manham, the character in Ian McEwan's novel The Innocent, is deployed to work on the Berlin Tunnel operation in the early 1950s when he strikes up a love affair with a German woman, Maria. New to both espionage and love, he reconciles struggles to reconcile his two worlds. He had spoken to no one about Maria at work, and he could not talk to her about what he did. He was not certain whether his time spent travelling between his two secret worlds was when he was truly himself, when he was able to hold the two in balance and know them to be separate from himself, or whether this was the one time he was nothing at all, a void travelling between two points. Others, like Len Dayton's unnamed spy who calls himself crafty, nasty, suspicious and irritable, has no one to come home to. But when he does come home, it's a kind of anchor, as he takes strange pleasures in handling well-known implements in a well-known place. If identity begins with a name, won't spies have as many identities as pseudonyms? And in all this confusion, ambiguity and deceit, won't they lose themselves, their sense of purpose, their values? Is spying inevitably cynical? Dealing with others on the basis of pseudonyms and assumed identities Dayton's unnamed spy tells one of his agents called Johnny Vulcan, "The moment that you think you know who your friends are is the moment to get another job." To which Vulcan replies, "You've become so good at pretending to be different that you've lost contact with your identity." And that brings us, I think, close to spy fictionist pessimism, of which Le Carré is the master. In his fiction, spies struggle to identify and identify with a cause. Everything is maybe. And if they did, what would be the point anyway? Because spies, we are told, abandon first what they love most. His characterizations have pushed the world of spy fiction into a darker, bleaker landscape. Where Bond is seriously haute couture, Lemus, the spy who comes in from the cold, is haughty, has a utilitarian approach to clothing and almost everything else. The Soviet spy master Kahler is a little wiry chap who appears modest and avuncular, lacking the scars, the cruel smile, the very physiognomy of evil one might expect to find in such a character. Bill Hayden is winning, but of course, he's also the traitor. George Smiley, Le Carré's most famous character, is anything but Smiley. He's a podgy, absent-minded, late middle-aged, seemingly always coming back from retirement. His powers, like an old lover, are inexorably deserting him. And his one touch with beauty is his wife Anne, who is notoriously unfaithful, and in a cruel twist collapsing the boundaries between the personal and the professional, has been seduced by Bill Hayden, all part of Carla's scheming to put Smiley off his game and off Carla's scent. Le Carré can write. Some of his set pieces are dazzling. Fiedler's debriefing of Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Smiley's interview of Grigoryev in Smiley's People, and the scenes, as Bob mentions in his book, involving the likes of Connie Sachs. What I find particularly interesting, though, is the nature of Le Carré's pessimism. The layers of cynicism and betrayal in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold have an ironclad logic. As Lemus falls to the ground, shot in no man's land, that cruel and grisly space dividing East and West, he sees innocence and humanity waving cheerfully, childlike, whilst being crushed like a small car between the great lorries of Cold War politics. As Lemus doesn't really believe in anything and has no friends and is duped by his superiors, his fate both echoes and subverts the maxim expressed by E.M. Forster, "I hate the idea of causes, and if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country." If Le Carré pulls back from this bleak vision and the Smiley trilogy, then it's not by much. Consider Smiley himself. At the end of the trilogy, Smiley's defeat of his long-term nemesis, Carla, seems worse than meaningless. Watching the lonely figure of Carla shuffle across that bridge in Berlin from east to west, an unholy vertigo seized Smiley as the very evil he had fought against seemed to reach out and possess him and claim him despite his striving. At that moment, Smiley can't escape the thought, "I have destroyed him with the weapons I abhorred, and they are his. We have crossed each other's frontiers. We are the no men of this no man's land." A cautionary lesson for the spying business, perhaps. Or has Smiley tricked himself with what James Bond of all characters would call his own little sophistries? After all, Carla has left a trail of dead bodies and would have likely killed many more. And he is, as we've learned throughout the trilogy, a fanatic who would rather die than disown the political system to which he was committed. An absolutist for whom killing has never been more than the necessary adjunct of a grand design. Smiley knows firsthand from his earlier unsuccessful attempt at that prison in Delhi trying to lure Carla to the West that Carla has none of those usual fears or foibles of character by which men might betray or be pressured to betray their country. If Carla was ever to be defeated, Smiley had always thought it would be because of, not despite, his fanaticism. But Smiley, it turns out, is wrong. And here's the killer blow. Carla's perverse revenge on Smiley, if you like, Le Carré's surprise assault on the citadel of Western values. Rather than his fanaticism, the only victory, Le Carre seems to say, that would reconfirm Smiley's already tepid belief in the political system he serves, Carla's undoing begins in the least expected place. That is to say, in his love for a daughter who suffers from advanced schizophrenia and can't be helped by a punishing system that diagnoses her disease politically rather than medically. So Carla risks everything to shepherd covertly his daughter into the West to receive the care she needs. As Smiley slowly unpicks Carla's unauthorised operation and his murderous attempts to cover his tracks, Smiley realises that Carla's downfall, if Smiley chose to bring it about, would be caused by nothing more sinister than excessive love, a weakness with which Smiley himself, from his own tangled life, was eminently familiar. Using this intelligence, Smiley reluctantly pressures Carla, an adversary who has all of a sudden acquired a human face, to defect. Not the most pleasant of tasks, but hardly the moral equivalence Le Carre implies. So as a reader, I ask all of this merely to insinuate, wrongly, that liberal democracy might be as bad as Soviet dictatorship? If that is Le Carre's conclusion, and I think it is, then I can't help but recall, tongue only slightly in cheek, the character Mathis Bond's French liaison in Casino Royale. After patiently hearing out Bond's doubts about their profession, Mathis comments, "Englishmen are like a nest of Chinese boxes. It takes a very long time to get to the centre of them. When one gets there, the result is unrewarding, but the process is instructive and entertaining." Spy fiction became so closely associated with the Cold War. How has it fared since its end? Some writers, I think, have struggled to come in from the cold. Le Carre's ambivalence has blossomed into full-scale cynicism, and his later novels, such as The Constant Gardener, Absolute Friends, The Mission Song, condemn more than reveal. The cleverness of Russia's Mortal, set in the 1990s, is that he makes the seeming hiatus in global power structures caused by the collapse of the Soviet Union its meaning for the world of spying, and by extension for spy fiction itself, into the predicament of his central characters and their lives. Ray, anticipating a recurring argument with his wife Iris, knew all the questions that were looming up. Why were they still in Botswana, or anywhere in Africa for that matter? Things were cyclical and got more harrowing each time, but undoubtedly the collapse of Russia, the astonishing collapse of all that power, was telling her it was the moment to dismiss what he did for the agency. Despite Iris's concerns, spy fiction does track geopolitics, at least in its broadest shape, and there is an emerging genre of spy fiction dealing with the rise of authoritarian nationalism, like Daniel Silva's Moscow Rules and Alex Dryden's Red to Black. Nevertheless, among the string of works attempting to take on 21st century terrorism, I'm yet to read one that rises to previous heights or quite grasps the significance of that global threat. And maybe that's why the best contemporary spy fiction is found, I think, and here I agree with Bob's judgment in his book, in the historical spy novels of Alan First. Full of atmosphere, suspense, courage, people already battered, bruised and scarred by the Great War, his books take readers into a Europe on the precipice of World War II. We already know the ultimate outcome of the coming conflict, but First has us suspend disbelief as we inhabit an uncertain, gritty world where the best intelligence requires great patience and may only provide partial insights. Significantly, spying in First's universe, despite the many disappointments, thwarted efforts and failures, doesn't equate to cynicism. This year has seen the release of the 22nd Bond film, the most famous spy franchise, as well as a new Bond novel penned by Sebastian Foulkes. With the resurgence of Bond movies and of popular spy thrillers, spy fiction seems to ask readers to choose: Fleming or Le Carre, Bond or Smiley, gloss or grit. In terms of my own preferences, if I'm reading for literary merit or tradecraft, for careful and patient analysis, as much as I enjoy Alan First, I think it still has to be the Smiley Trilogy. If I'm reading for a rollicking good yarn that helps sustain faith in liberal democracy, then it's probably Ian Fleming. But I'm sure you want to know which is closest to the challenging and important work we do at ASIO to protect Australia from espionage and terrorism. Which work, which, as Ray says of himself in Mortals, involves bringing out into the light designs that, for their own usually bad reasons, certain people want kept hidden. Whether in doing this, ASIO is located in a kind of space between an upmarket casino called Royale or a dilapidated training facility called Sarat, well, you'll just have to apply to find out. Short of that, you could read our unclassified annual report to Parliament. The narrative may not be quite as gripping, but it's definitely fact, not fiction.
Sometimes you can recall how you first fell in love with a book, and I remember Europe 1974, our first trip to Europe, being enthralled by Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I couldn't stop turning those pages. Many of you would be familiar with it, but it's a story of how George Smiley, called back out of retirement, is given the job of finding out who is the senior spy in the circus. Who is the Russian mole in this branch of British intelligence? Is it Tinker? They use code names. Taylor, Soldier, or Spy? Smiley's interrogation of colleagues, some of them former colleagues, some of them out of the service, is one of the delights of Le Carré's fiction, but the climax is definitely in the Locked Garden safe house in Camden Town by the canal. They've set it up so that having provoked the Russian spy located at the Russian embassy in London and the as yet undetermined senior British intelligence officer who's in the pay of the Russians, they will wait with the place bugged, with the safe house bugged, to hear which of their colleagues arrives and is greeted by the Russian. The mole comes first, Smiley thought. The mole plays host. That is protocol. The front door opened. Smiley's listening to this on his headphones up in the attic. The front door opened. Someone stepped into the house. Immediately, a second taxi pulled up. Then he heard voices. What is our cover story in case we are disturbed? Polly Yakov asked in good English. He's the Russian. What is our fallback? There was a muffled murmur. They couldn't yet tell which of their colleagues it was keeping this appointment. What will you drink? Asked the Russian. Scotch, says Hayden. A bloody great big scotch. Because he knows the game is up and he's there with his Russian contact to negotiate his exit out of the UK as agreed over the decades and back to his first love, Russia. The thing that grips me, as it obviously grips Paul about Le Carré, is how it's driven by character. You take that character, Bill Hayden, who turns out to be the Russian mole. He was played by Ian Richardson, the late Ian Richardson, in the TV series. And here he is described by Le Carré. He was a pre-war set that seemed to have vanished for good, which managed to be disreputable and high-minded at the same time. His father was a High Court judge. Two of his several beautiful sisters had married into the aristocracy. At Oxford, he favoured the unfashionable right over the fashionable left, but never, never to the point of strain. From his late teens, he'd been a keen explorer, an amateur painter of brave, if over-ambitious stamp. I like that, brave, but over-ambitious. Several of his paintings now hung in Miles Sircom's Fatuous Palace and Carlton Gardens. He had connections in every embassy and consulate in the Middle East and used them ruthlessly. He took up remote languages with ease, and when 39 came, the circus snapped him up. They'd had their eye on him for years. He had a dazzling war. He was ubiquitous and charming. He was unorthodox and occasionally outrageous. He was probably heroic. The comparison with Lawrence was inevitable. And there he is set up to be the great traitor within the British intelligence service. But as Paul's acknowledged, it's Smiley who's our hero, and what a character he is. He's described as small, podgy, and at best middle-aged. He was by appearance one of London's meek, who do not inherit the earth. He seems to dress expensively in black, but his overcoat sleeves are too long for his arms, and the London rain always accumulates on his glasses. He collects old editions of German poetry. His wife, Lady Anne Stepney, keeps leaving him. "George, how can you be so vulgar?" a colleague puts to him. "Nobody divorces Anne. Send her flowers. Take her to lunch." So Alec Guinness played Smiley in that BBC TV series. But I love the way in Smiley's people, called back to solve the problem of the death of the Russian emigre general in Hampstead Heath. He looks at a roll of film, and he's at home now, and he's home in Chelsea, and he lies on the couch, and he's worrying out, as Paul does most nights of the week, the identity of the face captured on this secretly snapped roll of film. Here's how Le Carré describes it. "Wakefully now, he stretched out on the sofa, and with the print before him began plodding through the long galleries of his professional memory, holding the lamp to the half-forgotten portraits of charlatans, goldmakers, fabricators, peddlers, middlemen, hoods, rogues, and occasionally heroes who made up the supporting cast of his multitudinous acquaintance." So there's the spymaster, with all the accumulated knowledge and half-knowledge of those decades in the service, racking his brain to identify who that face is. He knows it. He recognises it. And the Rolodex is spinning in his mind. It's a great novel. It's a work of literature. It starts with an attempt on the life of an old Russian woman in the hot streets of summery Paris, and then with the murder of this Baltic, I think Estonian, Russian general. He's in exile, he's an agent of the British, he's been their best Russian agent for years, on Hampstead Heath. His body's found in Hampstead Heath. And how do these two plot lines intersect? The attempt by some Russian hoods to bundle off an old Russian woman on the streets of Paris, and the murder of a general in the Russian army on Hampstead Heath. The characters are great. I mean, Smiley, in trying to penetrate this plot, has to go and interview a former spy, someone he picked up in the ruins of Vienna after the Second World War. His name's Toby Esterhazy, and out of the service, he's now running a little art gallery in Bond Street selling fake Degas. And he's kind to Smiley, because Smiley picks up a statue of a ballerina and goes to finger it, and he says, "You know, what provenance is this?" And Toby says, George, don't linger there too long. Don't linger there too long. And Le Carré describes Toby Esterhazy as a small and dapper figure, quite motionless. His full white hair was swept back with bravado. He wore a black suit with broad stripes and shoes with pantomime buckles. The stripe was definitely too big for him. And that little adjective, pantomime buckles on the shoes, puts Le Carré in the category of Dickens. He writes later about the grubby old exiles, the headquarters, the Baltic Immigrant Organisation in London, its little windows squinted down into a forecourt of the British Museum. Well, that's what Dickens does. Its little windows squinted down into the forecourt of the British Museum. And who captures dialogue better than Le Carré? After this murder, the bureaucratic head of the circus, and this won't make Paul cringe with embarrassment, because he doesn't, well, he occupies a similar position. He doesn't talk in this bureaucratic language. But Oliver Lacon has Smiley in, because Smiley's got to solve this problem for him. And he's got to give him some background in the bureaucratic manoeuvring that's been going on. So he says, and this is wonderful bureaucratic dialogue, he says, 3 years ago, George, let us start there, soon after you left the circus, your successor, Saul Enderby, your worthy successor, under pressure from a concerned cabinet, by concerned I mean newly formed, decided on certain far-reaching measures of intelligence practice. I'm giving you the background, George, he explained, interrupting himself. I'm doing this because of who you are, because of old times, and because, he jabbed a finger at the window, because of out there. Now that dialogue is brilliant, a dialogue of the senior British cabinet factotum. And later on, another one reflects on Lacon in talking to Smiley, and he says, Brother Lacon told you the facts of life, I suppose? The stalemate and all, Enderby asked. Young, idealistic cabinet, mustered for detente, preaching open government, all that balls, ending the conditional reflexes of the Cold War, sniffing Tory conspiracies under every Whitehall bed, ours especially. Did he tell you they're proposing to launch a damn great Anglo-Bolshe peace initiative, yet another, which will duly fall on its ass by Christmas? That's wonderful. I think the high point of Le Carré is when Smiley interrogates, peels back the layers to get to the heart of the problem. The high point of Alan First is the border crossing. Take one from his novel Red Gold, where Casson, who's a French movie director, is working as an agent of the French underground in occupied France. He's got to make a journey pretending to be an insurance inspector from occupied France across the border into Vichy France to pick up arms in Marseille to bring back to Paris a whole truckload of semi-automatic weapons to arm the resistance. But at the border crossing, he's interrogated by a Vichy policeman. And your heart is beating, your heart is in your throat as you read this. The Vichy policeman knows nothing for sure, but he pretends to know that Casson's papers are not in order. Where is that office? 22 Rue Labautie in the 8th arrondissement. And your supervisor? Monsieur Labaté. And your address? I live at 8 Rue Fortuny. As Casson talked, the official made notes with the scratchy pen he dipped in an inkwell. Please step outside, monsieur. Casson goes and waits outside the office. He sees the policeman, the Vichy policeman, make a phone call and make some notes. Then he gets called back in. And the police chief says, fake. Your documents don't check out. Casson looked puzzled. How can that be? Will you tell me? Casson shrugged, amused by his own confusion. Well, I don't know. The spelling of my name, perhaps? There's a possibility you and I can work this out. Just a possibility, right here and now. And then you can go wherever you're going, but you have to tell me everything. If you do, I might be able to help you. That was a temptation. Casson lived up to it. He shook his head. Fault in the records? I don't have any idea what it could be. And then he's allowed to go. And out on the station, when he's inquired when the next train to Marseille will arrive, he reflects. Suddenly he was grateful for the whole pirate ship of characters whose life had stirred up. Lawyers, studio executives, actors, agents. Forgive me, my friend, he thought, but I've been down that road too many times. In other words, he recognised the bluff and he was up to it. I agree with Paul that betrayal is a persistent theme of this fiction, and I draw your attention to a Le Carré that appeared in 1995 called Our Game, which has a retired spy opting to take on the British government and side with a colleague who's gone off to join the Ingushians, a nation in the Caucasus, which is resisting Russian encroachment and Russian tyranny and Russian atrocities. So it's interesting to me that Le Carré, moving out of the Cold War, will opt to dramatise an argument against what he sees as Russian imperialism. And it's a very interesting work in that sense. One of the great appeals of this, and I haven't got time to deal with it now, I'll bring this to an end so Paul and I can enjoy your questions, is spycraft. And two beautiful examples from first fiction always appealed to me. One is from the Polish officer, and that is the Jewish chemist in Poland, occupied Poland, who's lost just about everything and knows soon he will lose his life. But he's applying himself to gathering reports for British intelligence, and what he analyzes is cotton wool. Cotton wool found in dumps, in garbage dumps. Cotton wool that has been used to clean the rifles. What he does as a chemist is to analyze the chemicals that are on that cotton wool. If it's a fluid used to clean these rifled metal surfaces with a low viscosity, it's not useful. That rifle oil is not useful in temperatures below -5 degrees Fahrenheit. The moment the Germans changed the nature of that oil used to lubricate the barrels of the rifles, he knows they're preparing for winter warfare. Thought it was a great introduction to spycraft. And the other one, and it's a heart-racing scene, is from occupied Paris, also from the novel The Polish Officer, when in a hotel room on the left bank there's a British agent tapping out a message. She's got information to get to London. It's night, best time for sending radio messages. She's got material that will be used by pilots of the Royal Air Force. And she knows she's got 15 minutes to get this into the stratosphere before there's a danger of the Gestapo radio vans closing in. And first switches between her room and the seedy hotel and the room in one of the Gestapo headquarters where they're tracking her message and sending out the direction-finding Gestapo vans with a street map of Paris, tracking her messages and closing in block by block. They get her, but fortunately she's got cyanide pills secreted and can take her own life before she is tortured in one of the Gestapo prisons. I'll conclude with this. All of this represents an encounter with totalitarianisms. It brings us up against the evils of the last century. And as I say in my book, My Reading Life, all of us have got to confront this human proclivity to indulge in totalitarianisms, to tolerate them, to apologize for them, to invent them in the very first place. The totalitarianisms of the Italian and German fascisms and some of their offshoots that we find delineated, as Paul said, in Alan First novels, or the great smouldering totalitarianism of the Soviet Empire that finally comes undone. For me, a devotee like Paul of La Corée, above all, the Cold War ended not with the events of 1989 in Berlin. The Cold War ended that night on the bridge when Carla, shuffling and lonely, emerged from the shadows and was willed across by Smiley. And Smiley said, "Win, win." I suppose we did.
Thanks, Curtis. Thanks to Mellisons for the use of this facility tonight. There's some copies down the back of My Reading Life, and Bob Carr would be happy to sign them. All proceeds to a very good charity. If anyone's got a copy of last year's annual report, I'm sure Paul O'Sullivan would be the same now. The ASIO annual report, I always read it myself, but not for the fiction. Okay. So we've got about 15 minutes, so we've got a bit of time for question and discussion. I think we'll take questions broadly on the topic rather than broadly off the topic. So we're sort of talking fiction tonight. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question to both our speakers, and that is, whilst being a self-confessed devotee of Le Carré, like both our speakers, I've more recently come to discover a far less fertile field, and that is Australian spy fiction, of which I only know two examples. One is Christopher Kosh's recent The Memory Room, and a 2004 book by Warren Reed called Code Cicada. And I wanted to draw your attention to this because our speakers have not read it. It is a good homegrown example of the genre. Warren Reed happens to be a former diplomatic colleague of Paul's. He then served for 10 years in ASIS. So he knows his trade.
Okay, think about it, yeah.
Okay, but I wanted to ask if either of the speakers have read it and if they have any comments on the Australian genre.
Well, I think I might get Bob Carr to tackle this one.
The answer's no for me.
You haven't read it? Yes. I haven't read it either, but I'm sure if Warren wrote it, it would be pretty good fiction, I think. Christopher Kosh has been here at the Institute, but actually reading poetry as well. Okay, this is,
To what extent are these spy fictions perhaps disguised exposés? Because ASIO was really on the heels of many so-called academics, you know, decades ago. And these academics, you know, they try to theorize and write books. For instance, Knight's book was forbidden to be published, if I remember right, and yet he got it published. Could he have written, you know, Knight, could he have written a book rather than based on fact, or put the facts into the genre of fiction? Can I pose the question to both of you?
Well, I think we're talking about David McNair.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, he wrote a non-fiction book on Australian spies.
Yeah.
I mean, can I just ask you before you answer that? I mean, do you regard yourself as a spy? You don't spy. Well, just talk to the mic.
The question is, what's it worth? I mean, look, the answer to the question is an interesting one about, you know, to what extent is spy literature a sort of expose or a sort of deflected or reflected sort of description of what goes on in reality. That's what's the relationship. And one of the interesting things to get an answer to that, or one of the ways you might get an answer to that question, is to look at the novels written by a woman called Stella Rimington, who at one stage had been head of MI5 in the UK, and after she retired from that job, she then went and reinvented herself as an author. The thing I think about her books, at least the ones I've read so far, is that they're actually rather uninspiring novels. And the reason they're uninspiring might get to the question, actually, because what she simply did was, and this got her into some difficulty with her former colleagues, she simply took normal work behaviour, as it were, changed the names of some of the people involved, and then published it as a novel. Now, it's sort of interesting if you want to read about operational behaviour in MI5. What it's not very good at is this fiction. And part of the reason it's poor fiction, in my view, is that she's got very, very poor understanding of how writers develop character and how they make you understand the world that and the psychology of the chief protagonists inhabit and why that leads them to take the actions that they do. So if you read Bob's book, I mean, you get an explanation from him and some observations from him about exactly that theme as he's just reflected here this evening. Well, if you read Stella Rimington's novels, you might get an insight into MI5's daily grind, but what you don't get is any insight into the psychological condition of the characters.
Milton Osman,
Both our speakers spoke very warmly about Jean Le Carré, and I wonder whether they have a comment on the extent to which, as David Cornwall, he trained for the British SIS and served in British embassies overseas as a member of the SIS. Does that matter? Obviously, in Stella Rimington's case, it didn't lead to her developing Liz as a very believable character.
DFAT types doing the Alfred Reed spy.
What are you doing?
One of the things I concluded after interrogating my own reading, why I liked books, why I didn't like books, is that we among other things, we want the book we open to have an authenticity. And if I think about the books I put down, not able to finish them, it's generally been because I couldn't believe the characters, couldn't believe the circumstances. They lacked authenticity. I should be a bit critical of Alan First. I wasn't able to finish a book that had many excellent features, and that's Night Soldiers, about someone who's collected in Bulgaria, trained by the KGB, and sent off to Spain. He flees the KGB and tries to vanish into France because of the purges. If he goes back to Russia, he just knows he'll be killed in one of the purges. But it ends up with action sequences. And many of First's stories are just spoiled for me because they go for B-grade movie-style action sequences. He seizes a barge on the Danube. He single-handedly loads that barge with explosives. He blows it up, and we know that for the next 6 months no oil can reach the Nazis down the Danube. It's just unbelievable. Now, La Carrée has got impeccable authenticity. For example, those two quotes I gave you of the talk of British bureaucrats in the 1970s, Oliver Lacon and the other one, it's just authentic. And the techniques you sense are authentic. They persuade you. The relationship that the circus had with the emigre general who was found murdered. You know, a bit of money, never enough, he lives in poverty. And the people who succeeded Smiley in running the circus didn't treat him seriously, but to Smiley, he was one of their best all-time agents. He gave them big secrets out of Russia. And I just think the time he spent in the British Foreign Service enabled him on every page to give us the authenticity without which any attempted fiction fails. What does a writer do but tempt us to go in, to step in to an alternative universe? And as readers, we're exploring the vision of the writer. We're like an explorer with a lamp in a cave and looking around at the world of wonders that Flaubert or La Carrée or D.H. Lawrence has created for us. But we're not going to inhabit that world unless we think it's authentic, that it is real. That it is an alternative universe into which we can step. And his years in the diplomatic service just gave him that rock-solid authenticity, in my view.
The test that you can't finish reading a book, which comes out in my reading life, but as I recall, he couldn't finish reading Don Watson's biography of Paul Keating.
No, it's simply because it was too long. It had many, many good things in it. Yeah. It was simply too long. I mean, he's the expert in every book. He's read every book in Australian history and Australian politics. But I thought one of the good things in I suppose, your history of the Liberal Party, Menzies' Children, or John Edwards' book on John Curtin, they didn't attempt to be brick-like tones. If you can write a complete history of the Liberal Party, how many pages?
300.
Yeah. Then, you know, Don Watson being pretty audacious in having us, you know, sign up for, 6 months of reading to get through to the end of the Keating government.
Okay, now. Right, up the back, yeah.
I've read that John Duncan's Hero of the Green Mantle was based on, in part, on A.B. Herbert, and that Ian Fleming's James Bond may have been based in part on Fitzroy MacLean. Did speakers have any clues as to whether the more modern heroes who they were based on?
So I think I might go to the ASIO director.
Well, the short answer is no. If it were true that Buchan's novels drew on particular characters he knew, or that subsequent writers drew on features of or people who they'd met and then features of other people, but the fact of the matter is that most of the fiction is a composite as Bob says, I mean, it's partly what intrigues us is the quality and the authenticity of the tradecraft, but it's also the, for me anyhow, it's the psychological fascination that goes with that tradecraft. What does it mean to be a spy? As I tried to allude to in my prepared remarks, I think there's a very big set of issues there, and it may well be that people who are in the game, such as Le Carré, have the best insight because they've had to think about those things from their own direct personal experience. So, but anyhow, whatever the sort of the features that Buchan accumulated in his characters, or that Fleming accumulates in his, what we deal with is the finished product. And what's fascinating is, especially with Fleming, is that, you know, 50 years after they were published, the novels keep on attracting readers. The movies have become a sort of cult, and they are, you know, so eagerly awaited the next reinvention of Bond. And I think that's partly because the character himself catches up something we all would like to be, part of us would like to be, and part of the values that he represents are values that we to some extent share. And I think what's interesting is that out there in popular culture, Bond retains that appeal. You don't really see in popular culture Smiley, or let alone Carla, that sort of appeal.
So there's a question here, let me go there. Yeah. Very brief.
My reading of spy fiction is more limited, and I don't know how many spies I've met in my lifetime. I may be meeting some even now. But I did meet one major spy in my lifetime, almost 50 years ago, in England, doing postgraduate medical work, and having a flat in the eponymously named White House. There were a lot of other people. The name is Blake.
Ah.
And his first name was not, I think, William, but I don't remember.
George Blake.
And my question really in relation to the fiction is, this was a large block of units, and among the other people in this block, there was a former Miss Australia who befriended me, and I befriended her. And we were invited to a party at the home of Mr. Blake.
Yeah.
And Mr. Blake was subsequently exposed as a fairly notorious agent for the Soviets. What my question is this, I can tell you more about them. I have been asked.
This is a long and short question.
I have been asked. My question to both is, does Mr. Blake figure in any of the fiction that has been written since? Because I haven't come across it. He's a very colourful character.
Well, I think, Bob, you can answer.
I think the key here is, and Paul used the term composite, Le Carré had plenty of material to draw on. Philby, Burgess, MacLean, Blake, and the others. It was all there. All he had to do was manufacture composites. There's been some speculation about the British spy master that inspired Smiley. But didn't inspire Smiley. No. But I don't think it's useful. I think in a master writer like Le Carré, you've got a capacity to take characteristics of there and him and there, and to allow his imagination run riot with these circumstances. Alan Bennett, we should mention. There's a wonderful play recently revived in London called, I think, Another Country. An Alan Bennett play. When the curtain goes up, you think you're on a, you're outside an English country house. Then you realise that the forests are pine forests, all of uniform age, and there's something sort of Central European. You're in fact in Russia, and the British man living there is in exile. He's a spy for the Soviet Union, who was swapped, and he's living in Russia. But he's full of nostalgia, as indeed Burgess was during his years there, full of nostalgia for very British things. And when his brother-in-law arrives with a mission to get him to go back and accept a couple of years being a librarian in a jail, and then be welcomed back into the sort of bureaucratic world that Paul knows in the Australian context, he's tempted to do it. His brother-in-law has brought him a little packet of presents. There's some marmalade from Fortnum and Mason's. There's the latest Anthony Pohl novel. And there's the latest recording of some music by Elgar. And it all does the trick. He's on the next flight.
We'll take a final question here, then we better wrap it up. Yeah.
Has modern day spy craft become so technologically advanced so as to render it an infertile ground for literary fiction?
That's a good question which to end. I think Bob, do you want to respond to it? We're going to pull this up. I need to pull this up, this question. Tell us what you do.
Well, but the question was about whether the technology renders the profession unsuitable for fiction. It wasn't whether it's useful or anything else. So I'll answer the question. Before I answer the question, what I should say is my view is that no matter how good technology is and how much it develops, and both of those things are very serious issues for me and for ASIO, technology will always have to compete with and be supplementary to and supportive of human activity, because at the core of spying, if that's what we're talking about here, just as at the core of spy fiction, there will always be those concepts of loyalty and betrayal. And that's a human decision. It's not a decision that can ever be achieved by a machine. Machines can help you understand what the choices people face are, but they can't tell you what those choices will ultimately be. So spy fiction, like spying in reality, will always, I think, be dominated by human behaviour, not by technology.
Many thanks. I'll be very brief. When Bob Carr rang me up a few months ago and said he'd had a lunch or a dinner with Paul O'Sullivan and they wanted to come along and speak about spy fiction, I thought it was probably a long lunch. And so I hesitantly rang the ASIO Director General's office because I was worried they would think I'd had a long lunch too, and said that. And they said, "Oh, we're waiting for you to call. That's all right." So I thought this would be great fun, and it has been great fun. As I said, we've had Mr. O'Sullivan here before speaking as ASIO Director General. We've had Bob Carr here speaking as Premier of New South Wales. But what we had here tonight was two very intelligent commentators speaking about very important areas of literature, and I've learned a lot. And we've had a bit of fun, and they'll be good papers, and they'll be up on our podcast tomorrow. No doubt we'll have both back sometime in the future to speak about something else, but tonight's been great, and I'll remind you about my reading life, but for now, just to say thanks to Paul O'Sullivan and Bob Carr for a great evening. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.